Good morning, everyone. This is a holiday edition of the Monday podcast of The Daily Friend. And you can tell it's a holiday edition because I'm introducing it. I am Sara Gon, the editor-in-chief of this, podcast, but I think it's of the newspaper, The Daily Friend. And I'm with Gabriel Krauser, my colleague and analyst and journalist. I'm not quite sure what all the terms are.
Right. How's it, Sara?
How's it? It's got a holiday feel about it because some of the issues we're going to discuss are perhaps a little bit beyond belief. And yeah. The first one being, shall I refer to the headline as Government to Ban Foreign Business?
Yeah.
Do you want to try and unpack that for us,
right,
humanly possible?
So this reporting comes from a meeting of the Kgalema Motlanthe Foundation, where the Justice and Correctional Services Minister, Ronald Lamola, was speaking to the problems of xenophobia, I suppose, and of economic meltdown, and also of the inability of the NPA to really get its job done. But he said that what really needs to happen is that we have to draft legislation that has to be, quote, realistic to the kind of dynamics. We are not going to wake up and have a massive deportation of Zimbabweans and Mozambicans and Lesotho nationals. So it sounds fairly sweet in a way, excepting that he goes on to say, and I quote again, it must be clearly stated that no foreign national can run this kind of a business. Now, it's not 100% clear which businesses he means, but it is 100% clear that he thinks foreigners shouldn't be allowed into certain parts of the economy, sort of based on what, the kind of industry. So does he imagine that foreigners shouldn't be doctors, or foreigners shouldn't be lawyers, or foreigners shouldn't be running spas or shops?
I think it's probably the latter, and it's a sort of ham-fisted way of failing to deal with xenophobia and trying to deal with xenophobia while you show that you are, in fact, xenophobic.
Yeah.
I mean, you made the comment, not so much in jest, but how are we going to identify the foreigners who may not own secondhand clothing shops? Are they going to be wearing white stars?
Yeah.
It's absolutely bizarre. Apparently, the Minister of Small Business, whose name escapes me for the moment, is drafting the legislation. And what worries me is that this sort of legislation, not only is it patently racist and unconstitutional in the sense that it interferes completely with the right to follow whatever business course you so desire, but it's the sign of a government that's not doing what it's meant to do properly. And so in the absence of success, you legislate, and that's what they're doing. I mean, it's unenforceable. What they do and need to do, I would say, is go back to basics, and that is ensure you have proper controls, border controls, and the admission of applicants for residency to this country the way you would probably with the doctors or the accountants or the financiers that you would welcome to the country. Mm-hmm. So it would be laughable if it weren't so essentially racist and unfair.
Yeah. No, it's flat out. And there is a way in which it's already happening. 2 years ago, when I was doing research with Rian Milan on the xenophobic question under the Institute of Race Relations umbrella, one of the things that we found in Soweto was, a lot of 90% of foreign of spaza shops seem to be foreign owned. Mm-hmm. Anecdotally, this is what we seem to come across. Gigi Alcock is a real expert of that region, and that's the figure that he puts it. Cassinomics author. And we were going around and we wanted to find a local spaza shop owner, and we really couldn't. Mm-hmm. But we came close. We found a local guy who owns the space in which the spaza shop is happening. Mm-hmm. It's being rented out by Bangladeshis, and they make their sales. And he's got a liquor store next door, part mm-hmm. of the same complex. And the story that he told us is he said locals You'll never find foreigners running a liquor store because to run a liquor store, you have to have a license and licenses will never be issued to foreigners. So I said the foreigners have to do the, you know, sweets and other nappies stuff. And peanut butter business and the locals get to do the liquor trade. But to, I mean, so that's like a bizarre way for things to turn out. And a lot of it is down to the fact, you know, studies have shown on average takes 6 visits to get your documentation, visits to Home Affairs, and more often than not, the difference maker is giving a bribe. The central sort of I can't remember the name of that building now, but this sort of centralized space for dealing with foreign nationals in refugee mode was run by Bosasa. I mean, it was a complete nightmare. So people don't have they're in a very tricky situation because they, you know, the borders are open, it's a problem, and then all of the buildings are corrupt. All the government buildings that their paperwork needs to come from are corrupt. So you've got this bizarre situation where the license is never going to go their way. Imagine if we had an explicit law saying that foreign nationals are not allowed to sell beer. Because that's like only for black South Africans.
Yeah.
Or it's just, it's madness.
What concerns me is every time there's a riot that has xenophobia at its source, you hear comments like they're taking our jobs, they're ripping us off, et cetera, et cetera. But it's got to be something else because they can't take jobs that South Africans aren't creating. And this suggests that there's a different approach towards business by immigrants who will probably be creative in every sense of the word because they need to keep body and soul alive. And a completely different attitude by South Africans, which seems – there seems to be, but I say this open to correction, an element of entitlement perhaps, an expectation that jobs will – be made available instead of the fact that you actually have to scrap for jobs. You have to create them. You have to try and do something if they are not forthcoming as they should be through growth of the economy.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot to that. I was looking at the minimum wage. Yeah, I think partly there's an entitlement thing. Partly we legislate our own working poor out of work. If you look at the minimum wage and the median wage being, you know, if you put everyone in a line in South Africa from the highest income earners to the lowest income earners, who would be in the middle? Our median wage and our minimum wage are basically the same.
Yeah.
Basically both sitting at 3,500 rand. Now, there's no economist in the world who doesn't think that means anything but basically you're making half of people almost impossible to employ. You're getting all of their employers to start looking for how to get a machine or some workaround solution to deal with that. In countries, you know, the UK's minimum wage to median wage, it's like a third. The minimum wage is a third of the median wage. In South Korea, it's like a fifth. In China, it's like an eighth of the median wage. So you have very, very genuinely low minimum wages. For us to have that, the minimum wage in South Africa would have to be something like 1,000 rand a month.
Yeah.
But now the trouble is, and I think a lot of the stories that we came across of foreign nationals is that they found ways to work for 1,000 rand a month when they got here, selling curtains. You know, classic thing to do is you get the curtains and you have to go sell them and then pay the money back for the original thing. And then if you've got an extra 20 rand at the end of it, that's your calories for the day.
Yeah.
You know, you keep going like that. The thing is, people who work in those positions are often able to work their way up. They gain skills, they become more productive, and that means that they're able to extract more value as well. And then you go from selling curtains, you know, one of our sort of the stories that we went into quite deeply, this guy goes from selling curtains for 5 years ago to now he's got a flat in Rosebank and he's sending his kids to a middle class school and he's, you know, he's working at a cell phone company and he's making over 10,000 rand a month. Yeah. Good for him. You need to let people be able to do that, and we don't let South Africans do that. Harder for them to work.
The thing that has to be recognized, there seems to be this romantic notion amongst politicians that, you know, that we can create or invigorate entrepreneurship. And in reality, entrepreneurship is a very rare thing. Very few people have that. And they need to be employed. And the minimum wage stops that from happening. And what's got to be understood is that you've got to get on the ladder. Once you get on the ladder, the potential to go up is there. And what I don't understand about the union position on this is that the advantage of having people in employment for, say, R1,000 a month is an opportunity to sign up people as members and then to press for improvements in their working conditions. Mm. I mean, that is a sort of ABC of how economies work. Mm. And this, I mean, what's interesting is so many of our leaders who would not allow us to follow this model were union leaders at one stage. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure where they expect to grow their membership if an economy is shrinking. Their membership has got to shrink with it.
Oh, I don't know where they think they're going to grow.
Okay.
But I just want to say one sweet thing about the foreigners that could happen, and that's such a terrible missed opportunity.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll turn the corner. You know, we've got this fourth industrial revolution, new dawn, awesomeness, cities in the sky made out of glass and digits. There is a real opportunity here for one of the biggest problems for foreign nationals working in South Africa, especially those who run their own businesses or are making kind of below minimum wage, is that they're sitting with a lot of cash, but it's especially the spaza shop guys sitting with a lot of cash. If you've got a spaza shop that you're extracting, able to live, pull a profit of 2,000 rand a month, then you've got at least 20,000 rand in cash kind of going through there at any given time. So if you're very cash heavy, you're a risk.
Mm.
You're a hazard. It's very easy to be robbed, and I've sort of documented conversations with 60 foreign nationals, and I can hardly find any of them that haven't described being robbed at some stage in their time here, often multiple times. If they could get onto the banking system, it would completely change the game.
Mm.
What would it take to do that? Well, we've got very strict finance laws, and that's good because you don't want toxic assets getting onto the books. We all know what happened in America 10 years ago, and so on. So, but there are ways of registering. You know, this is really a space where the phone kludge can come in, and it's been done already in Kenya and in the subcontinent of Asia, where you allow people to get digital identities and then use those digital identities to get e-wallets that they can readily trade in and save themselves from being so cash heavy. You know, people can basically be paying with airtime and that kind of thing gets sequestered in the right way so that the banks don't end up sort of turning them into CDOs.
Right.
This could all be done. I spoke to someone who was at the World Economic Forum where xenophobia was the big issue in the room about the fourth industrial revolution and how we're going to do, use cell phone technology and digital identities and stuff like that. Foreigners weren't mentioned once. It's not like a priority in a way to our leadership. It seems very callous and inhuman. Now we must make it very clear that foreigners can't be in certain businesses. There's something extremely cold.
It's very cold. And of course, it's cutting off your nose to spite your face. And I'll end on the subject on this point. And that is this. If those people can be registered to open bank accounts and can hold bank accounts, they're also people who can be required to pay tax.
Exactly.
And that goes across the board, all those complexities of trying to start a business. I mean, we had a discussion here that dealt with that last week, and it was actually, I knew it was bad, but I didn't know it was that bad.
No, it's really bad.
Let's just have a quick look at the day we are celebrating tomorrow, and that is Heritage Day. And I have a sort of slightly cynical take on it, and hopefully Gabriel, you'll argue against me. Heritage Day was originally a day recognized, it was a holiday in support of or in praise of King Shaka.
Yeah.
So it was very much a Zulu, a day for the Zulus.
Yeah.
Then when it came to our negotiations, 93-94, there was a lot of tension between, inter alia, the ANC and the IFP.
Yep.
And the IFP, for a range of genuine reasons, was going to walk away from the table. And one of the things that was going to happen is the ANC was going to scrap the day as a holiday, because it being specific to one group only. And the IFP said, if you scrap the day, we're not coming back. We want the day. And the ANC agreed to give them the day.
Mm.
But instead it would call it Heritage Day, being in celebration of all the heritage, of everyone's heritage around the country.
Mm.
One understands the political dynamic for it. And the idea of celebrating heritage is not per se a problem. There is only one problem. We used to, in terms of it, celebrate heritage. Everyone celebrated their own in a small way. People often came to work dressed up, reflecting their heritage. And there was an element of, it was fun, and there was an element of promoting an understanding.
Mm.
I think with the political, the slide in our political fortunes, that sort of celebration has gone. People don't talk about celebrating anything anymore. And I think the problem is that we can't celebrate a shared heritage, partly because we, to some extent, have one, but we all have individual or group heritage to celebrate. And I think this has become cynical and fairly meaningless. I think also the problem is that, given that fact, it's another day where the economy loses money by saying on the 24th of September we will have Heritage Day, instead of doing sort of more the English or American thing of saying the third Monday of September or whatever it may be.
Mm.
So we tend to be awash with holidays, some which are genuinely more symbolic than others, but which take money out of the economy that we cannot afford to take off. And we need to be we need to say that the recognition of Shaka's death on the 24th of September will be recognized together with all the other heritages on, as I say, the third Monday of September.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my gripe about Heritage Day.
Okay, I hear you. I'm going to play the other side.
Okay. Not devil's advocate necessarily.
I like Heritage Day. Because I like public holidays, I like spring.
There's the problem.
I'm a youth, I like having a braai, you know, it's like a pretty time
now
of the
that
year.
That is probably the one aspect of Heritage Day that most people would agree with, because in our own different ways we all look for an opportunity to braai.
Yeah, we do. We dig it. And there's, I suppose there's something... to your point about South Africa is so economically depressed. We're in the longest, you look at the Reserve Bank, according to the Reserve Bank, we're in the longest negative business cycle since World War II. Okay, yeah. It's like we're running on 50 months or something. Mm. It's
bizarre.
It's very, very tough. Instead of a new dawn of invigorated, competitive, creative growth being sort of channeled by... good application of consequences through the law to those who have stolen and looted our national fiscus blind. We have a new dawn of socialism, push the signature policies or expropriation without compensation, which is fractious and does damage to the idea of inheritance. It rattles us. There's the NHI, there's the Credit Act, there's prescribed assets. So not only are we in a depressed economy, but we're also looking forward to just more solutions to our problems that are actual major problems.
Yeah.
And it does make it hard for us to come together and say how fabulous it is that we've got all these languages and all of these styles of dress and all of these ways of preparing food and enjoying the wonders of spring together.
Mm.
It is very difficult to do. I think that I think every nation has to... It's when things start going better, and they'll probably have to get worse before they do get better. When things do get better, it'll be nice for us to have held on to this day, I hope.
Mm.
And in this particular dark hour, I would like to encourage listeners to consider, I think, the greatest concentration of South African art that's ever been gathered, really, in an exhibition that's opening tomorrow on Heritage Day in Pretoria.
Right.
It's a new building. It's to celebrate a new art space. It's called the Javits Art Center.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Javits, a rich man.
Yeah.
He left a lot of money to create a space to house South African art. Stefan Vals was a collaborator. Mm. He's one of the greats in the art world. He passed away, And Christopher Till is the MD, and he runs the Apartheid Museum. He really knows how to make a thing run.
And so the
brief for this exhibition opening, it is such a Heritage Day thing, is 101 artworks made in South Africa by South Africans from the last 101 years. So you get this wonderful sense of how different and colorful and interesting this country really is. And I saw a preview of it, and as miserable as the economy is and as terrible as our leadership is, there really is a lot of vibrant, exciting, creative South African talent.
In fact, generally in the arts, with a few exceptions, and they've tended to come and go, the variety of the art displayed, of music played, etc., is actually extraordinary and has managed to withstand the sort of the divisiveness that has been part of our politics, and that has enormous appeal. I agree with you. I think I would encourage our listeners to go out, go to what are called
the Javits Center at the University of Pretoria.
Okay, cool. That to me does have appeal. Maybe I'll retract my cynicism.
And it does bring in the money. And you know, the art that we sell to the Americans and the Brits brings in a little bit of money, which is nice.
Well, that's the point. I'd like to end off with our Lord's rugby prayer. It's a little bit out of date in the sense that it anticipated something that didn't quite happen on Saturday, but it hopefully it's not too late, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes as follows. Our Booker, who art in Japan, rugby be thy game. Thy tries will come. The Rugby World Cup will be won in 2019 as it was in 2007. Give us this day our daily penalties, and forgive Etzebeth for his trespasses, and penalize those who trespass against us. Lead us into celebration and deliver us from New Zealand. With the Webb Ellis Cup, the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy Heritage Day whichever way you see it, and appreciate South African art in any form you can. It's very diverse and I think actually unique in very many ways. If you want to read what we have to say about South Africa, South African politics, socioeconomic issues, please go to www.dailyfriend.co.za. And if you want to get much more involved with the Institute of Race Relations, sorry, I've done that before, with the Institute of Race Relations, all you have to do is SMS to 32823 or go to our website, ir.org.za/join, and you can join and really help support us to be out there and fighting the good fight. With that, hopefully we'll see you on Wednesday, post Heritage Day and all that that implies. From Gabriel and our technician, Mbali, have a good day.